From South Carolina Public Radio, this is the South Carolina Lead. I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode was recorded on October 17th, 2024, from South Carolina Public Radio Studios here in Columbia, the same place we're going to have our live lead taping on October 30th. Spooky, yes. It will not be a spooky pod. You can come dressed up. I won't be, but it will be here in Columbia at 6 p.m. The taping begins at 6:30. It's free.
Wow.
There will be swag that's also free. You can meet us. It's somewhat free. It's moderation encouraged. You can ask questions for free, and we'll also have some adult beverages.
Wow.
Now, this will be our pre-election show featuring Friends of the Pod, Meg Kennard with the Associated Press, and Mayon Schechter with South Carolina Public Radio. So come see us October 30th at 6 p.m. RSVP required, but free, at southcarolinapublicradio.org/live-lead. LIVELEDE. Now, on this episode of The Lead, we look at the week on the campaign trail with insight and analysis from Congressman Jim Clyburn and South Carolina Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick. Yes, folks, the national meets the state level. We also give you a look at the latest from the South Carolina ports. You better believe your boy was down at the docks. I'm a maritime lawyer. They need my expertise.
Arg, me matey.
I need your expertise. And in order for you to do that, you need to call me at 803-563-7169. We can even get a little political in the wind down if you guys want to talk about voting. Early voting starts next week. You want to give us a shout, let us know who you voted for. We can keep it and maybe use it as a little roundup. Maybe not for the wind down, but give us a shout if you early vote next week. We will use it in the show. 803-563-7169. I still have not heard from anyone on what the Halloween costume I need to wear will be.
Walk the plank.
We've been trying to reach you about your homeowner's extended warranty expiration. 803-563-7169. Your home warranty depends on it. Another week has ticked down as we approach Election Day on November 5th, but you don't have to wait for then to vote. That's right, starting on Monday, October 21st, you can cast your ballot early at any early polling location in your county through November 2nd. Some counties have one location, bigger ones have multiple.
Interesting.
That's right. If you got somewhere to be on Election Day, then go ahead and locate your polling location, review your sample ballot, and more at scvotes.gov. They don't pay me to say this. I'm just doing this because you guys need to know. Now, if it's our Saturday pod, then we're giving you a bit of a recap from some of the top moments from the presidential trail. But don't worry. I also have some insight and analysis from two top politicos in our state. 6th District Democratic Congressman Jim Clyburn and South Carolina Republican Party Chairman Drew McKissick. Let's start with Congressman Clyburn and Vice President Kamala Harris's week.
Go ahead!
You'll remember that we focused a lot in our last episode about Harris's outreach to black men, a key demographic in the Democratic Party that some polling has her behind previous Democratic presidential nominees. Even former President Barack Obama called out men for essentially being misogynistic and not supporting Harris. His words, paraphrase there, remarks that some have called lecturing or condescending, whereas others would maybe call it a hard truth. I spoke to Clyburn about this and other issues on This Week in South Carolina.
I think that what you're seeing now is demonstrative of the fact that she is ready for this job. And if you look at her resume, look at the resume of all of us. She just has an incredibly good resume. And I think she's demonstrated in the last several days that she has a spine of steel and a mind that is really up for this task.
And when you say the last several days, do you mean some of her interviews that she's been doing, including that Fox News interview Wednesday evening?
Yes, absolutely. You know, people, just look at the Fox News on yesterday. I don't know how she had the sense to know that questioner was not being totally honest with what he had put up on the script, up on the screen. Now, you know, people who maybe she saw the show earlier in the day, but I think that she acquitted herself extremely well with that. And I think she did that in the debate. And that's why 4-5 is refusing to debate anymore. And he's hiding something from the American people. And it's the reason he will not sit for any interviews. And of course, I thought it's kind of interesting as I listened to excerpts from that Fox News on yesterday. It's kind of interesting to me that the misrepresentations that they continue to make, they seem to be getting away with it. Mm-hmm. I don't know why the country has evolved into this love affair with misrepresentations and outright lies, but that seemed to be where the country is.
But when you look at that support and her maybe lack thereof support or slipping support, I should say, about black male voters, how concerned are you about that? And what do you think that root problem is?
I don't think there's any slippage. Once again, think that who you talk to, I go, maybe it doesn't look like it, but I go to a barbershop every 2 weeks. I'm not hearing what people tell me they're hearing in barbershops. I was raised in a beauty shop. My mom's had two beauty shops when I was growing up. I had about 16 operators in those beauty shops. I was in and out of those beauty shops all the time. And so I know what the culture is in the beauty shop. I'm not hearing or seeing what is being reported about this. You get one or two people who, for whatever reason, may speak well of Donald Trump, and that becomes black men. No, mm-hmm. That ain't black men. That it may be two black men, but that's not a reflection of what I'm hearing with African Americans.
Do you have any reason to be concerned when it comes to voting in this country, in our state? Do you have any reason to be concerned about the security or the fairness of our election process in our state or our country?
Well, I'm not concerned about the security of the vote. I'm concerned about the vote that took place in the first place. That's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the kind of violence at the polling places that we saw in 1876. Look, I'm not making this up. It's all right there in the history books. I've been studying it all of my life, and I used to teach it. And what you see taking place today in these legislatures, what you see taking place today at these polling places, we've got a mayor up in Wisconsin that has been arrested for carrying off a drop-off box. This is the kind of stuff they did in the 1870s when they were trying to bring on Jim Crow.
Now, you heard Congressman Clyburn there mentioning Harris and her interview with Fox News host and journalist Brett Baer on Wednesday evening. This was Harris's first interview on the conservative-leaning network and was an example of why many Democrats shy away from doing them, because it was more of a debate performance than an interview. But she gave controlled and detailed responses as well as plans and worked to prevent Baer from repeated interruptions. Here's part of that 26-minute interview.
So decriminalizing border crossings, like you said in 2019.
I do not believe in decriminalizing border crossings, and I've not done that as vice president, and I will not do that as president.
So these are evolutions you've had.
No, but let's be very clear. I'm the only person who's running for president who has prosecuted transnational criminal organizations, from the Sinaloa cartel to the Guadalajara cartel, to people who have trafficked in guns, drugs, and human beings. I have spent a significant part of my career going after people who present a threat to the safety of the American people and cross our border with the intent of doing us harm and cross our border illegally. And I will do that work as vice president. I take that work quite seriously.
This is a time when voters, especially here in Pennsylvania, are inundated with commercials and ads. They just want it to stop because it's every commercial. But many of them add noise, but a few of them seem to break through. This particular one from the Trump campaign has gotten a lot of attention.
Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
For prisoners. Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
So are you still in support of using taxpayer dollars to help prison inmates or detained illegal aliens to transition to another gender?
I will follow the law. And it's a law that Donald Trump actually followed. You're probably familiar with, now it's a public report, that under Donald Trump's administration, these surgeries were available to, on a medical necessity basis, to people in the federal prison system. And I think, frankly, that ad from the Trump campaign is a little bit of like throwing, you know, stones when you're living in a glass house.
The Trump aides say that he never advocated for that prison policy and no gender transition surgeries happened during
his presidency. Well, you know what, you've got to take responsible for what happened in your administration.
Yeah, no surgeries happened in his presidency.
It's in black and white.
Would you still advocate for using taxpayer dollars for gender reassignment surgeries?
I will follow the law, just as I think Donald Trump would say he did.
You would have a say as president.
He spent $20 million on those ads, trying to create a sense of fear in the voters because he actually has no plan in this election that is about focusing on the needs of the American people. Whereas, at $20 million on that ad, on an issue that, as it relates to the biggest issues that affect the American people, it's really quite remote. And again, his policy was no different. Look at where we are, though.
They say
on plans for the American people, I'm offering a plan to deal with affordable housing. I'm offering a plan to deal with what we need to do to strengthen small businesses, which are the backbone of America's economy. I am offering a plan that is about taking care of young parents and giving them the support they need. My plans for the economy will strengthen the economy, as have been reviewed by 16 Nobel laureates, Goldman Sachs, Moody's, and recently the Wall Street Journal, which have all studied our plans and have indicated my plans for our economy would strengthen our economy, his would make them weaker, would ignite inflation, and invite a recession by the middle of next year. Those are the facts.
Why do you think more people say they trust him on the economy than they trust you?
I think that when you look at an analysis of our plans for what we would do as President of the United States, it has been clear to those who study and understand how economic policy works that moving forward, because I do believe the American people are ready to turn the page on the divisiveness and the type of rhetoric that has come out of Donald Trump. People are ready to chart a new way forward, and they want a president who has a plan for the future and a plan that is sound and will strengthen our country. My plan for the economy does exactly that. His plan would be, again, to give tax cuts to billionaires and the biggest corporations in our country and blow up our deficit.
Let's go from that interview to Drew McKissick, SCGOP chairman, who I spoke with on TWSC, yes, the TV show. Drew told me he is not concerned about any election security issues in the state and told me this when I asked him about that black male vote.
Well, what you've certainly seen, no matter what anybody would like to say or predict about what's going to happen, what we have seen in the past is a trend. We've seen a trend of more African Americans, more Hispanic Americans voting Republican, particularly black men among African Americans, to be sure. And actually, I believe in 2020, you had Donald Trump receive the highest percentage of African American and Hispanic American and Asian-American support of any Republican nominee since Richard Nixon back in 72. So we've seen this trend line over the last several cycles. That's good. I think that's indicative of what we're going to see again in a couple of weeks. And again, I've heard, you know, just anecdotally here in South Carolina in a lot of the districts that we're focusing on here, of black men in particular not being excited about the Democrat ticket, to the point where I heard that from three different campaigns a few days before Barack Obama made his statement last Friday. And I thought, well, now if they're hearing that,
you're talking about congressional, state house?
State house, state senate seats here around the state. But if they're hearing that to the point where they have to get Barack Obama to go out and make that pitch, and then you have Kamala Harris come out and make a pitch about forgivable loans and legalizing marijuana and other things, which I thought were, you know, overly pandering, and I think a lot of black men think we're overly pandering, makes me feel a lot better about how things are going.
So when you hear these things, specifically here in the state too, do you see the party which you chair doing more to reach out to these demographics?
Well, absolutely. I know our candidates are. I can see that in terms of, you know, who we communicate with, who we mail, who we call on phones, doors that we knock, and so forth. You know, you've seen the Republican coalition nationally and here in South Carolina expand, particularly since 15 or 16, to, you know, include a larger swath of what people would refer to as working class families. And that's, you know, white Americans, black Americans, brown Americans. It doesn't matter. I mean, people who have, you know, a job and they're trying to make it go for their family and they have a, you know, basically a traditional value sense of how to live and how to raise their family. That's allowed us to expand our majority in the State House and the State Senate over the last three election cycles to a supermajority in the State House and one away from a supermajority in the State Senate now.
Mm-hmm. And well, again, we'll get to that, I promise, but I'll ask you about early voting. We were just talking about that, but also the security of our elections. A lot of people make a lot of hubbub about, you know, potential fraud. We had the Attorney General on last week, and he mentioned that there's concerns that they're trying to run down to try and check with the Department of Homeland Security when it comes to possible illegal immigrants on our rolls. We've heard from other election officials saying that they've never seen that happen. There's never been any illegal immigrants voting. How secure do you see our state elections at this point? How much faith do you have in them?
Well, here in South Carolina, we didn't have the problems that other states did back in 2020, famously. After that election, you saw in 21, we passed a major piece of election reform here in South Carolina, election integrity bill, which, by the way, passed unanimously in our legislature. Very bipartisan bill.
Good to see that every now and then.
We were very, very proud of that. And, you know, we clawed back on the mail-in absentee system a good bit, but in exchange for that, we opened up an early voting system, 10 days of early voting in person, where you have to show the photo ID, much more secure than mail-in absentee ballots. So if I felt good about things here and how they were run here in 2020, I certainly feel better about it now. That doesn't mean that there aren't always things that you can do or look at to potentially make changes, because, you know, those who would like to take advantage of the system are always thinking and trying to change what they do. So you have to be a step ahead of them. You know, but here in this state right now, we feel good.
Well, talk about these down ballot races here, Drew, because obviously we have the congressional races going on, kind of a foregone conclusion in many ways, just based on gerrymandering and how the maps go. State House races, there's about a handful of those that y'all are watching. Again, you're talking about trying to shore up and get some bigger majorities in the State House with 30 Senate Republicans already right now and 87 House Republicans. Tell me about some of these races. Do you guys expect to have any pickups? Where are some of the more competitive parts of the state?
Well, pickups, I'm on the record saying we'll pick up at least two state Senate seats and two state House seats. You know, where, I'll leave that to everybody's imagination.
We've got to have some suspense on election
night. But look, we're focusing on where we have opportunities. And, you know, again, you can look at the map and see where we've won and what we don't have. And obviously, we're focusing in the areas where we don't have a Republican right now. I'll keep my Democrat friends guessing about how much resources we're putting in any of those districts. But, you know, suffice it to say, we've got a good message, we've got good candidates, and you have President Trump at the top of the ticket. That puts us in a good spot to make pickups all around the state.
Trump's major interview this week was with John Micklethwaite, editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News at the Economic Club of Chicago. There, Micklethwaite asked Trump about his economic plans, in which he hammered on tariffs. These plans and others floated by Trump have been shown to add trillions more to the deficit compared to Harris's plans. Here is some of what Trump told Micklethwaite about his costly plans, which at times Trump rambled off as he does, and he even included a tie-in to South Carolina's auto industry, which could be operated by children.
President Trump, you talked a lot about tariffs. You look at the American economy, 40 million jobs rely on trade. It accounts for 27% of GDP.
Okay.
You cut that off, that's also going to have an effect on many, many business people here.
Yeah.
Tariffs also have another side. Isn't that something that you have to acknowledge?
No.
You could be plunging America into the biggest trade war since Smoot-Hawley.
But there are
tariffs. You're going to stop. There are tariffs already.
No, there are no tariffs. All you have to do is build your plant in the United States and you don't have any tariffs.
But people, in a lot of places like this, there are a lot of jobs that rely on foreigners coming here. You're going to basically stop trade with China. You're talking about 60% trade on that, 60% tariffs on that. You're talking, as you said, 100, 200% on things you don't really like. You're also talking about 20% tariffs on the rest of the world. That is going to have a serious effect on the overall economy. And yes, you're going to find some people who will gain from individual tariffs. The overall effect could be massive.
I agree. It's going to have a massive effect, positive effect. It's going to be a positive, not a negative.
Let me just tell you how
committed you are to this, and it must be hard for you to, you know, spend 25 years talking about tariffs as being negative and then have somebody explain to you that you're totally wrong. It'll have a negative. It will have. I'll go a step further.
President Trump, 40 million jobs is a lot of jobs to rely on.
They're all coming back.
Those are 40 million jobs in America that rely on trade.
Are you ready? John Deere, great company. They announced about a year ago they're going to build big plants outside of the United States, right? They're going to build them in Mexico.
And you threatened
they're also going to build
them. They stopped.
That's right. I said, if John Deere builds those plants and not selling anything into the United States, they just announced yesterday they're probably not going to build the plants, okay? I kept the jobs here, and I'll keep them. John Deere will stay here. And I'll tell John Deere, if you do build outside of the United States, you can if you want. For instance, India is a very tough country. It's not only China. You know, China is the, I would say, probably the toughest. But there are a lot of tough. You know what's very tough? European Union. Our beautiful European countries, wonderful, wonderful. If you add them up, they're almost the size of us. They treat us so badly. We have a deficit. I said to Angela Merkel when she was there, she's not there anymore, I wonder why, but when she was there, I said, Angela, how many Chevrolets do we have in Berlin? Why, Donald, you have none. He said, that's right. How many Fords do we have in Frankfurt? I don't know, none. I said, that's right. You know how many cars we have? Mercedes-Benz, BMW, all of the different Volkswagen, millions and millions of cars. And then I said, farm products, you know, they don't want our farm. They don't want anything from us. We have deficits that are crazy. And we're not going to have them anymore. We're going to put tariffs on them. And they're going to do, and you know what they can do? The Mercedes-Benz will start building in the United States. And they have a little bit. But you know what they really are? Assembly, like in South Carolina. But they build everything in Germany, and then they assemble it here. They get away with murder because they say, oh, yes, we're building cars. They don't build cars. They take them out of a box and they assemble them. We could have our child do it.
Can we come back?
Keeping with tariffs and foreign trade, yes, let's transition from the campaign trail to the South Carolina ports. Yes, okay. Permission to come aboard. Yes, for real, this isn't a maritime joke, folks. It was the annual State of the Ports address, and Barbara Melvin, SC Ports president and CEO, decided to change up the backdrop for the event and held it in a warehouse at the Columbus Street Terminal in downtown Charleston with about 1,200 folks who have ties to the ports. Before we get into the remarks made by Melvin, Lieutenant Governor Pamela Evett spoke with reporters at that event where she brought up presidential politics and her support for Trump. So I asked Lieutenant Governor Evett what she thinks about Trump's plans to put tariffs on everything and what that would do to port operations and foreign trade. Mind you, the top export out of the Columbus Street Terminal is thousands
and thousands
of BMW SUVs. I saw them all. They were all lined up, and I just was going to take one. They are shipped from the company's factory in the upstate down to the port from Inland Port Greer. Inland ports use rail. Hey, guys, not boats. But here is what the lieutenant governor said.
You know, I think when people talk about tariffs, and you heard President Trump talk about it yesterday, we're almost talking about it as a one-way street. Like, we'll interact with tariffs, and everybody will stand still and not do anything. I think what we've failed to be talking about is the art of the deal. And President Trump has been amazing with the art of the deal. And so, you know, he's going to come to the table and use all the tools in his toolbox. And that's one of them. And, you know, Vice President Vance, I don't think people talk about enough. Here's a guy, well, soon to be Vice President Vance, right? Senator Vance. Here's a guy who came from a small town who understands when there are unfair business practices, how it devastates small towns, how businesses move away. And so I think he brings a critical role to the table that people really aren't giving enough thought to. So, you know, I don't think it's just black and white. People say tariffs and not tariffs. We are a huge buying block here in the United States, right? And so we're going to have to make it a little bit more fair. And I think President Trump is the guy that can do it. And he's got ideas and he helped us one time around. I think he's going to do it again.
As for Melvin, well, it's been a tricky year for the shipping world, and SC Ports is no exception. Just a little tie-in to show you how everything is connected in the world. The U.S. military just sent two B-2 bombers to conduct airstrikes on an ammo depot in Yemen that Houthi rebels have been using. You're saying, why, Gavin? Why does this matter? Well, they've been using that ammo to attack ships transiting the Red Sea, which leads to the Suez Canal. Ever heard of it?
Yes.
Why would they do that? Well, because the Houthis have been attacking military and commercial vessels, which has then led shipping companies to reroute ships away from the area and instead go around the Cape of Good Hope, adding 10 days to the voyage. Not cheap. If you're wondering why costs are still high, ask the Houthi rebels, guys. This has been one of several challenges facing the shipping industry this year, as well as labor issues from the first East and Gulf Coast dock worker strike in 50 years earlier this month, as well as the labor disputes at the Hugh K. Leatherman Terminal in Charleston that were resolved this summer, restarting the terminal at its massive capacity of some 700,000 TEUs. That's 20-foot equivalent units, or just say containers, guys. That's eventually going to be scaled up to 2.4 million TEUs in the future as part of the port's plan to reach 10 million TEUs by 2050. That's huge. And that Leatherman Terminal just welcomed its first weekly call from Asia. Here's Barbara.
So let's talk about Leatherman. We celebrated together as a South Carolina maritime community a huge victory last month when we reopened. It was monumental for the entire port system and for our state. This reopening unlocks 700,000 TEUs of very much needed capacity in a 1,400-foot berth. And it provides more flexibility and fluidity within the U.S. East Coast port market, further supporting businesses that depend on our port on a daily basis. This state-of-the-art container terminal is big ship ready. 5 ship-to-shore cranes that sit 169 feet above the dock, and 25 hybrid rubber tire gantry cranes that work the yards.
The ports have seen major investment from the state and federal government. Now that the port has reached the milestone of the deepest depth on the East Coast, it's working to scale up its capacity to 10 million containers, like we said. This will be through expansions and investments across the ports that are fed by the Charleston Harbor. Hundreds of millions of dollars will go toward expanding the Leatherman Terminal, North Charleston, the Navy Base Intermodal Facility, railway infrastructure throughout the area, and more. Yes, it never ends, guys. So we still don't know how tariffs could all affect this, but again, a lot of investment going here at the port since an economic driver in our state. Back to the event, Melvin even broke some news with other officials, announcing a $195 million grant from the federal government for a new interchange at Long Point Road in Interstate 526 that will alleviate volume and congestion in that area, which feeds into the Wanda Welch Terminal. A lot happening down there, guys, including that strike earlier this month. Melvin said ports were operational the morning of October 4th after that 3-day International Longshoremen's Association strike. Workers cleared the queue of ships waiting offshore by October 9th.
In partnership with the ILA, employers, and the greater maritime community, we are once again moving cargo and providing excellent port service at Leatherman Terminal for the benefit of our ocean carrier customers and cargo owners. We reopened the terminal with a major weekly service from one of our ocean carriers, Zim. You see their box over here. The first weekly call was this past Saturday, and it worked very productively and very safely. This first in Asia call provides shippers with a critical weekly connection between Asia and the U.S. Southeast consumer market. This weekly service is the first of many to come, and we celebrate seeing cargo moving through that terminal again. The reopening of the Leatherman Terminal makes our entire port system more competitive in the Southeast, and we are nowhere near done. Today, I'm excited to announce that during our board meeting, we discussed a project to construct another 1,600 feet of berth for the Leatherman Terminal Wharf, which would give us a total of 3,000 feet of berth, 2 ships at a time, and we are opening those bids for that project on November 12th. So we hope to award this early part of next year, and that wharf construction will then be underway. A growing population and industry base makes South Carolina a great place for cargo owners to invest and ocean carriers to bring new services. Hint, hint. We are poised to grow our market share as more cargo flows through the Port of Charleston. During the last decade, shippers are routing more cargo from the U.S. West Coast to the East Coast, taking advantage of sourcing and transit times to key overseas markets, as well as being closer to the growing population centers of the Southeast. Let's face it, imports follow people.
The ports also faced a safety scare when a runaway ship was speeding out of the harbor, unable to be slowed down by the harbor pilot who successfully navigated away from the Ravenel Bridge, which was shut down as a precaution. and he steered it out to sea. This came months after the tragedy at the port of Baltimore with a container ship that lost power and destroyed the Francis Scott Key Bridge, killing six workers. The ports also faced a computer glitch, not a cyber attack, weeks ago that wreaked havoc on its operations for several days. The ports did see a dip in revenues and an increase in expenses year over year, according to its balance sheet, to the tune of a loss of $2.2 million. But its balance sheet remained net positive at just over $1 billion. Hey, you gotta spend money to make money. The port remains vibrant and a major economic driver in the state to the tune of $89 billion economic impact annually, and it supports 1 in 9 jobs in the state. This, according to Dr. Joey Von Nessen at USC.
Shout out.
I know you guys are wound up, but we did a lot in this pod, so we're not going to have a wind down. Have a good weekend. We will see you next week. AT's fine. He's here. Yeah, just he's fine. He'll be back next week. But thanks all for listening to the pod. You can give us a shout at 803-563-7169. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And stay up to date with the latest news on SCETV.org and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. And don't forget to support your local newspapers. The South Carolina Lead is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Amy Crouch is our supervising producer. Sean Birch is our executive producer. This podcast is produced with support from PRX and is made possible in part by a grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, as well as listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. For the South Carolina Lead, I'm Gavin Jackson. Be well, South Carolina.
Perfect. Oh, yeah.
Basically perfect.
Perfect.
I think I'm really going to like this. I'm pretty sure I'm going to like this a lot.